Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Israel, to where there are intensifying reports in the press that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are determined to bomb Iran soon, in the fall, before the American election. The former spokesman for Shimon Peres, Gideon Levy, joins us. He has an article at Haaretz, The Hour of the Warmongers, and we will discuss the growing alarm in Israel that their leaders are bent on war with Iran. Then we'll go to Madison, Wisconsin, and examine the local reaction to Paul Ryan's ascendance as vice president on the Republican ticket. Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, joins us to discuss the political skills of his neighbor in nearby Janesville, who regularly gets re-elected in a blue-collar district, appealing to working Americans, even though his policies and priorities benefit the super-rich, undermine the middle class, and punish the poor. Then finally, we will speak with sociologist Todd Gitlin about his latest book, Letters to a Young Activist, which teaches protesters and dissenters how it was done in the 60s and how it can be done more effectively today. As America lurches further and further to the right, we will discuss idealism, identity politics, and the legacy of activism in the 1960s, and whether similar protest movements can be revived today. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. Gideon Levy's writing is highly praised and noted for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as a Palestinian perspective. And he has an article at Haaretz, The Hour of the Warmongers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And when you talk about the Hour of the Warmongers, is Israel in a situation now that the United States was in under George W. Bush just before the invasion of Iraq, where there was a kind of war fever in the air? Is that what's happening in Israel?
I wouldn't compare, because nobody talks about the invasion into Iran. But Israel is very clear about its intentions, and Israel is very clear about her threats toward Iran. This is very clear. I mean, nobody can claim that this is not serious. It sounds very serious, it behaves very seriously, and I'm afraid that we are on the eve of another war.
But is it all coming from Netanyahu, or is there a group of politicians and military people that are advocating a military strike against Iran?
No, it's a very unique situation, which two politicians, two statesmen, Benjamin Netanyahu and Minister of Defense Ehud Barak, are pushing very, very hard for a long time in favor of an attack, while almost the entire military and defense establishment, in the present and in the past, they are all against it, or almost all against it. It's a very, very imbalanced situation, which on one hand, the political level is in favor, and the military level, which usually is supposed to be more militant, is very reluctant.
Well, surely, wouldn't it result in Hezbollah rockets raining down on Israeli citizens? I mean, isn't there an article? I was looking at Haaretz, and there's an article, a warning to Netanyahu from a writer who's saying, you know, what about the consequences to us, you know, from your desire to attack Iran? Are the public aware what the cost of an attack will be?
It's just starting now, because until now it was all about Iran having a bomb or not having a bomb, and nobody really paid attention to the price. And only in the very, very recent days, one, two, 3 days, the last weekend, the media started to describe the price, and I think that the nation mood is changing a little bit, even though I must tell you that the poll, which was published in the weekend, it clearly shown that there's almost a majority of Israelis who are in favor of an attack, almost a majority. But this might change when the price will be realized and explained and understood by the people who don't want an Iranian bomb. This is very nice. Who wants an Iranian bomb? A But one should be aware to the price of bombing Iran, and this might be a horrible price.
Well, but is there an Iranian bomb? I mean, there's no clear evidence that, one, that it exists, and two, that it will exist any time soon, at least according to the CIA here in the United States.
Yeah, nobody knows. We already have an intelligence fiasco in Iraq when everyone believes that Iraq possesses terrible kinds of weapons, and finally it was all about nothing. I'm not sure it is the case with Iran, but let's even assume that they are on their way to have a bomb. I mean, North Korea has a bomb, Pakistan has a bomb. We have to learn to live with it, no other choice.
Well, I believe, wasn't it the outgoing head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, who said that they don't have a bomb?
I beg your pardon?
I thought it was the former head of the Mossad who was quite categoric, saying, Maya Dagan, saying that the Iranians don't have a bomb. And they may well be trying to get one, but they don't have one.
Yeah. No, they don't have one. Nobody claims that they have one right now, but they are very, very close, or getting closer and closer to the capability of producing one. I mean, they don't have one. Nobody claims they have one ready.
Right. Well, then what is Netanyahu selling to the Israeli people? If you say the majority still want a strike against Iran, what is the rationale for this strike?
The name of the game is the Holocaust, Holocaust I and Holocaust II. Netanyahu feels that he is now in the late 30s, that Ahmadinejad is a Hitler, and he is the Messiah who will save the state of Israel from another Holocaust. That's more or less the frame of reference.
Again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz. He's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and he has an article at Haaretz, The Hour of the Warmongers. So if that's true, Gideon Levy, then it would seem that maybe there's a kind of symbiosis between the Israeli right and Netanyahu and the hawks, and the Ahmadinejad and Ayatollah Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guard Corps who are running Iran, they also have a kind of persecution complex based upon the martyrdom of Ali and all of this stuff. So is that do we have a kind of symbiosis here with a persecution complex on both sides feeding into this insanity?
No, I wouldn't go so far, because finally, Iran is threatening Israel and talking about extermination of Israel, while Israel is not talking about exterminating Iran or the right of Iran to exist. It's not. I wouldn't compare, and also comparisons are here unnecessary. Israel is going in a very, very dangerous path. And Iran is going to get a very dangerous start. This does not mean that both parties are the same.
Right. I wasn't suggesting they are the same, but I think the problem is that the Iranians' martyrdom complex may prevent them from being rational about trying to negotiate. I mean, clearly, the one thing that Netanyahu has achieved so far through his threats is he's got the international community quite concerned. And they're leaning heavily on Iran to make a deal, aren't they? I mean, because nobody wants the Straits of Hormuz closed. Nobody wants gasoline to be $10 a gallon and the entire economic global economy crashing, surely.
Yeah, this is right. But don't forget also that the international community is not stopping seriously Netanyahu of attacking Iran. I didn't hear very, very clear voices from Europe, and even not from the United States, really clear voices which call Netanyahu not to dare to go to an attack without collaborating it and coordinating it with the United States. So the international community is rather passive right now.
Well, I think the president of the United States is in a difficult spot, isn't he? Because it's very clear that Netanyahu is close to Romney, and Adelson, who's the biggest funder for Romney, is also very close to Netanyahu. It's no secret, I would think, that Netanyahu would prefer to have Romney elected. And that leads a lot of people over here to be somewhat suspicious about their motives, you know, because we've had that whole scenario of the October surprise under Jimmy Carter. It was never proven, of course, but it nevertheless was floated. And the latest reports from in the Israeli press indicate that there's a fear that this attack on Iran by Netanyahu may happen in the fall and even before the U.S. elections. So there's no question that this would affect the American elections if it were to happen, surely.
Yeah, it's all true. And time will show.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think, I mean, there's a lot of smoke. Where's the fire? Why are the press in Israel so up in arms on this story? And where's the actual evidence here? Is there any, or is it there just an assumption that this is the mindset? I know your newspaper, Haaretz, have had an editorial condemning Netanyahu for his denunciations of the non-aligned movement and trying to push Ban Ki-moon into not going to Iran. And Ayalon is declaring diplomacy dead. I can see why people think the clock is ticking, but what's the actual fire in terms of all this smoke?
Look, anyone who will tell you he knows will not be taken seriously. I really, there is so much misinformation in this game that it leaves all of us quite confused. I don't see a situation in which an American president cannot prevent Israel from attacking. I think that Israel is depending so much on the United States that it should be a very, very simple task to prevent Israel, you know, by some pressure, obviously, but it doesn't seem to be an impossible mission. And I don't understand how come that so many American officials have to come back and forth to Israel and beg Israel not to attack. I would expect it to be much more simple. And, you know, many times you forget who is the superpower here between the two, Israel and the United States. So I don't know really what is the role of the United States. I don't know really what is the role of Israel. I'm not sure that anybody knows. And only in a perspective of time we will understand what's going on here. Because logic, you don't find much.
Well, but surely there's got to be some memory. If we're talking, I'm not talking about the Holocaust type of memory, but the most recent memory was the war against Hezbollah that did not turn out that well. And we all know that that war made Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, a hero amongst the Arabs. Now, the reverse situation is happening now because of Syria and because of Nasrallah and his Hezbollah's support for Assad. They're actually on the ropes. So is Iran on the ropes. They may lose their important ally in Syria. If Israel were to attack Iran, they would reverse this entire situation and play right into Assad's and the Iranians' hands, surely. Is anybody discussing that in Israel?
Yes, they are discussing everything. But I wouldn't compare, because any operation against Hezbollah cannot be compared to this major operation against Iran. And also, nobody can compare the power of Hezbollah to the power of Iran. We are dealing here with a regional superpower. And the whole scale is different. I wouldn't compare. All the possibilities are more or less discussed in Israel. But as I said, we are quite lost in misinformation.
Well, but you would accept a proposition that this is a moment where Iran and Hezbollah are likely to suffer a great reversal in Syria. And if Israel were to attack Iran, that may actually strengthen the Syrian regime. I mean, isn't that a logical conclusion?
Sure. I just wrote it 2 days ago. Absolutely.
Right. Well, you know, I'm calling you to you know, the New York Times is carrying a story today saying that Israeli officials call for declaration that diplomacy with Iran has failed, and it talks about how the press over there are full of speculation that that Netanyahu is determined to attack Iran and may happen in the fall before the U.S. election. So clearly one's hoping to get some solid information, but I take it that there is none except how would you describe it? Solid suspicion that this is going to happen?
I really don't know. We should just hope for the best. What can I tell you?
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Gideon Levy.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz. He's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and his writing has been highly praised and noted for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as the Palestinian perspective. He has an article at Haaretz, The Hour of the Warmongers. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and go to Madison, Wisconsin, to talk with the editor of Progressive Magazine about his neighbor, who's just been nominated as the vice president on the Republican ticket. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who's the editor of The Progressive Magazine, which is published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Hey, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And you have in your neighborhood, I guess, in Janesville, Wisconsin, the man of the moment, Paul Ryan. We've just learned that this blue-collar, regular guy comes from a fairly wealthy family. He has worked for the government all his life. He's basically never been in the private sector, yet has managed to accrue a fortune of about $8 million. And he pales compared to his running mate, Mitt Romney. But in Wisconsin, do people buy it that he's just a regular guy? He's a kind of Joe the plumber.
Well, the thing is that Paul Ryan has a lot better people skills than his boss does, Mitt Romney, certainly. And he's able to do retail politics in a way that Mitt Romney doesn't. He relates to people well. He's there, pressing the flesh and in the July 4th parade and the Labor Day parade, and everyone knows him in Janesville as their neighbor or the guy who shows up at church, etc. So it's not like he's lived his life, behind a gate like the Romneys have, and it's not like he was born with that silver spoon in his mouth, though his family is doing quite well, as you suggest. But he's a good salesman. I mean, I think he's a snake oil salesman, but he's a better peddler of the myth of unbridled capitalism than Mitt Romney is, who just doesn't look the sympathetic part. Whereas you got Ryan there, and with his basset hound eyes and his unshaven face, can't he find a razor that works or a tie? Did someone steal all his ties? The down-home costume does get a little ridiculous at some point, but I wouldn't sell the guy short. He gets elected time and time again from Janesville, Wisconsin, 40 minutes from Madison, the same town that Russ Feingold, the great senator from Wisconsin, who got defeated 2 years ago, was from. My wife grew up in Janesville. I spent a lot of time in Janesville. It is a working-class town. It was a GM town, but GM shut down. It was the town of Parker Pen Manufacturing, these fancy pens, and that shut down. In fact, the manufacturing sector in Janesville and other towns in Ryan's district, that sector has been devastated, even as Paul Ryan has voted for one free trade agreement after another, which has shipped these jobs overseas.
So how would he compare to Scott Walker, who, as we all know, survived a recall? He comes, I think, from fairly modest background, more so, I think, than Ryan. You know, what I find extraordinary about the Republicans is that they can be both the arsonists and the fire brigade. I mean, Ryan voted for TARP, which is what propelled the Tea Party into being, their outrage at Wall Street. He voted for the huge boondoggle of prescription drugs benefit. But now he's out on the stump talking about how Obama's going to take away your Medicare when the opposite is true. It is so amazing. And I was just noticing your governor, he went to the Sikh temple the other day and put a thing over his head. And went to the service for all of the Sikh worshippers who were murdered by a Nazi, who was carrying a concealed handgun that is allowed in the state of Wisconsin thanks to Governor Scott Walker signing it into law.
Yeah, well, these guys are cut from the same cloth. You know, they are very good retail politicians who are peddling an agenda for the absolute super rich, both an economic agenda and a social agenda that divides working people one from another. After all, Scott Walker's motto was he was going to divide and conquer. That's what he told his biggest contributor, this roofer down in Beloit, Wisconsin, near Janesville, who is a billionaire, and who said, when can we get to a right-to-work state? When can we really, give it to these trade unions and get rid of them? And he said, well, we're going to divide and conquer. And by that he meant we're going to divide the working class and from the middle class, and we're going to divide public sector workers from private sector workers. And he succeeded in doing that. And Paul Ryan is succeeding also in putting the wool over people's eyes here on these economic questions. I mean, he sells himself as this, you know, economic genius, and a lot of the Republican pundits are saying he's the wisest mind that we have on economics. But, you know, he's the original, you know, one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind here, because after all, he blames Franklin Delano Roosevelt for deepening the depression, when in fact Roosevelt brought unemployment down from 25% to 10%. And similarly, he says Obama's stimulus package didn't do any good in his first 2 years. Now, just about every economist you talk to, including John McCain's former top economist, has recognized that the Obama stimulus package, insufficient as it was, still created, you know, around 2.5 million jobs. So he talks a good game, Paul Ryan does, but when you examine it, there's not that much to it.
Well, that was again in his speech the other day. He said that Obama has created the biggest deficit in American history, and of course they're running on that idea that trying to appeal to the idea that somehow the national budget's the same as a household budget, and where the government is living beyond its means, and you hardworking Americans who are trying to live within your means are being undermined by a profligate government who's throwing away all this money on a bunch of undeserving parasites who don't work. You know, that's what the attack on Obama's allegedly trying to give states waivers on welfare requirements, which is a made up issue. But, you know, your point is that had Obama not had a stimulus, we'd be in the Great Depression, number two. This is what I find extraordinary. How in God's name do they keep getting away with such brazen behavior? Every ad that Romney's put out is an incredible lie, but nobody seems to call him on it.
Well, it's amazing what people will believe, ultimately. And if they're told it time and time again, you know, chances are they'll believe it all the more. And part of the problem is that President Obama has not defended the progressive agenda defiantly enough and strongly enough and clearly enough For instance, even on the example that you mentioned about deficits, a national budget deficit being different from a household deficit, I've heard President Obama say on several occasions that the government needs to act just like a household, and we've got to balance our budgets and tighten our belts, and we can't, you know, let our children or grandchildren pick up the debt on their credit card or on the government's credit card and run up the bill for them. That would be immoral. So he sometimes sings from the Republican hymnal, and that's a real problem here. He also has offered or did offer at one point to engage in a grand bargain with John Boehner of the Republicans, a bargain about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the very issues that Paul Ryan runs on here. On these so-called entitlement issues. And even in the last couple months, the Obama campaign has said that it would be open to that grand bargain again in the second term. Well, if it's going to be open to cutting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, what is the real difference here between Obama and Romney Ryan? He needs to highlight the differences, not blur those differences up. And I'm just afraid that his rhetoric over time has been blurring the issues. Maybe he'll clarify them now that Romney has picked Ryan and Obama may think he has an opening. But I sure hope he will. Otherwise, I fear that even if Romney and Ryan don't win the White House by raising these issues, they're going to be gaining ground ideologically. It'll be a winner for the Republican agenda and a winner for Wall Street unless President Obama and Vice President Biden can really hammer Ryan into the ground by pointing out to people what he wants to do, which is nothing short of repealing the New Deal, repealing the Great Society, and returning us to a primitive capitalism.
But do you think that Obama and Biden can win this election by tearing the other guys down? Or, I mean, there was a poll, a focus group done by CNN that Amitai Etzioni told me about. He said where they asked all of the swing voters at present, what is the Republican narrative? And they could repeat it verbatim. They knew all the talking points the Republicans have. They said, what is the Democratic narrative? And nobody knew it. I mean, so I don't know what Obama and Biden are running on, do you?
Well, that is a real problem that the Democrats now for a generation or two have not had a platform that makes people's lives better and that's ultimately comprehensible. Welfare, as we know it, Bill Clinton threw that over, and that was a bone to, you know, the white working class that is that can be, you know, seduced by pretty thinly veiled racist appeals. And that didn't help people across the board. The earned income tax credit maybe with Bill Clinton helped, but health care reform for Obama helped a lot of people, but he's had a hard time selling that because he's, I don't know, either been unable to or afraid to sell it. It shouldn't be hard to sell. If you've got pre-existing conditions or you've got a loved one with a terrible disease, don't you want to be covered? Don't you want your kid to be covered? And yet the Republicans don't have an answer for that. I would think that's a winning issue for him. I wish he'd come out for single payer or a public option and Medicare for all who want it. But again, he was pitching himself toward the middle at that point.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in the country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. So do you think, you're in a college town there, Matthew, in Madison, Wisconsin, do you think that the youthful activism that showed up in 2008, that propelled Obama into the White House, and the Democrats, after all, picked up a substantial majority in the Senate, filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, a strong majority in the House. They had for 2 years. They had the trifecta. That's obviously nobody's thinking that that's ever going to happen in 2012, and most people think it's going to be awfully tight. Do you think that the 2008 youth vote will return?
No, it's going to be nowhere, and this is the problem for Obama. There's a ton of enthusiasm on the right to get rid of him, and yet the base that got him elected, the progressive base, the labor base, the youth vote, those forces that helped to elect him feel let down by him. Feel like he didn't deliver on the progressive agenda. He didn't really speak to or inspire young people until his late comments on the Dream Act and on gay marriage, but not enough. I mean, my daughter went door to door for Obama, and you know, she's pretty disgusted with him, and so are her friends. I mean, there isn't that movement to make history, it's also hard to make history twice. And people were inspired by Obama in part to make history, but also in part because, you know, he offered or suggested that he was offering something new and something bold, but he never defined what the new and the bold was, what the hope and the change was. And as a consequence, we haven't gotten a lot here. And people are not that excited about Obama this time around, excited enough to do the work that may be necessary to get him reelected. At this point, I still think he's going to get reelected, but there's not going to be that groundswell from young people, that's for sure.
And nobody thinks that that the Democrats are going to take back the House, or even they may even lose the Senate. So if he does get elected, presumably we'll have some serious gridlock, right?
Well, we'll have gridlock, and if we don't have gridlock, we may have disaster. And by that, I mean maybe Obama will compromise on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, or maybe Obama will bomb Iran. I mean, wouldn't it be a disaster if the difference on the Iran issue between Romney and Obama is that Romney would bomb Iran in the first couple months in office, and Obama would wait 8 months to bomb Iran? Boy, if that's the only difference, we're in a world of hurt. Of course, there are other issues, like the Supreme Court, you know, women's right to choose, and gay rights, where the issue are quite stark. I mean, here we have a guy in Ryan, for instance, who doesn't believe in abortion, even in instances of rape or incest or the life of the mother. So that's as right wing as you can get. But on some of these other issues, if there's gridlock, I'm afraid that Obama and his tendency is to compromise will compromise too much.
Well, but I think wouldn't the opposite be true? That we were just discussing, Matthew Rothschild, about what is the Democratic narrative? They don't have one. The best narrative they have is that I'm not the wrecking crew that's going to turn America over, to the oligarchs and corporate. You know, we'll have a corporate CEO running America. We'll have more John Roberts and Alitos on the court. We'll get rid of Roe v. Wade. I mean, it's pretty clear that there's going to be an aggressive right-wing agenda enacted if they get the White House. What's your assumption that he would want to compromise with the wrecking crew?
That's just because I've looked at how he's governed over the last 4 years and listened to his rhetoric, and his bargaining position is always to give away the most principled position he has before the bargaining has begun. And then if they're in gridlock, I mean, to get anything accomplished, he's going to feel that he has to bend even more to the other side. So that's a problem. But you're right, Ian. I mean, this is a very aggressive ideological attack from the Republican right wing that we see with this Ryan choice. And it needs to be hit head on. It can't be, you know, I agree with you part of the way. And I don't know why Obama keeps praising Ryan as a serious person and a decent man and a great family man. I mean, is he going to take the gloves off or not?
Well, that's what I was getting at, Matthew. It seems to me that the only argument that to vote for Obama is the old, unfortunately, the argument why people vote for the Democrats, particularly with the Supreme Court, is to hold the line against a complete kind of lurch into medievalism. You know, we already have our economy has largely become a plutonomy. Our game show democracy is largely being captured by the oligarchs. So if they get the court and they get all their social issues involved, then this is going to be a very strange and uncomfortable country to live in.
Well, the oligarchs are going to win either way. I mean, I think we should face that. But the question is whether on social issues, whether this country will turn rapidly to the right as it would under Romney and Ryan. But certainly, you know, Obama hasn't hurt Wall Street terribly, and they still pretty much run the show. Wall Street and the Pentagon run Washington, and Obama hasn't been strong enough to defy them.
Well, yeah, and this time around, they gave him a ton of money in 2008, and now they're giving it all to Romney. So, if he doesn't decide who his friends are and who his enemies are, I think we're all in trouble.
Well, we are in trouble, and we're in trouble until we get money out of politics, until we overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court case and amend the Constitution that says money is not speech. And corporations are not persons, and affirms the right of the government to regulate campaign contributions and expenditures. Otherwise, you know, we're living in a plutocracy right now.
Well, do you think that that is an adequate kind of rallying cry? I mean, in the Vietnam War, of course, people had skin in the game in the sense that the younger generation were being drafted. Do you think you can build a countervailing movement against the oligarchy? I mean, at a cultural level, it's done. I don't know whether you've seen the movie that's out now with Will Ferrell, but it really does, you know, at a cultural level, make it extremely clear what's happening to this country. But at the political level, you've got the Occupy movement that basically says a plague on all your houses. We don't, you know, we hate the Democrats as much as the Republicans. They do talk about campaign finance being a central issue. How do you build a political movement around these sort of issues as opposed to, you know, some kind of manifesto?
Well, I think it's important to build the mass movement for the issue and not for the political candidate. And I think on this issue of amending the Constitution to overturn the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, I think that's a popular issue. A vast majority of Americans understood that allowing corporations and the wealthiest Americans to give unlimited amounts in campaign advertising was somehow taking our voice away. This isn't the democracy of one person, one vote. You know, this is, you know, if you've got $1 million, you got to, you know, you can spend all that money and run ads every night. Who among us as citizens can run ads every night for a candidate of our choice? That's not a democracy at this point. And so I think this move to amend the Constitution is gathering steam. There is a grassroots movement for it in cities and states across the country. People are passing referendums in favor of amending the Constitution. And I think really fundamentally that's what it's going to take. You know, once Election Day is over, we got to get serious and amend the U.S. Constitution to take money out of politics finally.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the editor of the Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country, and he's the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Todd Gitlin about his new book, Letters to a Young Activist. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Todd Gitlin, an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of the Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and the author of Undying, a novel. His latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Gitlin.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And just to start with the Vietnam War, because what's come into focus now for me and for the audience, because we've been talking about it in the last few days, particularly since Paul Ryan was chosen as the vice president on the Republican ticket and may well become the next vice president of the United States. He seems to be the kind of continuum of something that happened in 1972, the famous Powell memo that was in large part a response to the Vietnam War and the protesters. The Supreme Court Justice Powell lived next door to the head of the Chamber of Commerce. They were appalled by the anti-war movement and the fact that students were dropping out, and they wanted to correct the course and have a whole generation of young Americans instilled in with corporate values and right-wing ideology, and they set about it with funds from billionaires and big corporations to set up think tanks, etc. And they've been incredibly successful. And in many ways, Ryan is a product of this machinery that has basically changed the course of American history. Now, I know it's a long-winded preface, but the question is, the anti-war movement that you were a big organizer of, as soon as that war ended, it went away. So I see that as an amazing paradox, that this massive movement that mobilized disappeared, but the movement in reaction to that massive movement has basically taken over America.
Well, this is a very big subject. The I think the starting point for appreciation of the dilemma is to recognize that the right, roughly speaking, is unambivalent about power, and the left is ambivalent about power. The left of the new left of the 1960s wanted reforms, but it was very much a self-starting, self-inventing movement. It aspired to be, as the phrase goes, the change it wanted. And in other words, there was a counter-institutional edge. We don't like the way the welfare system works. We don't like the way public housing works. We don't like the way the professions are organized. We're going to do it our own way. There's a grassroots insurgent, up from below, self-invention, if you will, social entrepreneurial edge there. And this means that that left, and we see its extensions today in the Occupy movement, which I've more recently written about, the emphasis is on self-creation, on what we ourselves can do or be for each other, rather than the taking of power. And in fact, there's an active allergy. There's a sort of self-immunization against power. So the left didn't, you know, it was not only ambivalent about authority from others, it was also ambivalent about its own authority. And thus, again, you see this played out in spades in the Occupy movement, which is, of course, averse to making demands and having designated leaders and structures and so on. I think there's actually a bigger story here about the right. You know, that America's been living on borrowed capital and productivity, and the string was running out already in the early 70s during that Lewis Powell period you talk about. The world of Paul Ryan is a world that got dislodged, and you know, he himself, I mean, it's important to understand him as a devotee of Ayn Rand, but it's also important to understand him as the scion of a very successful, very prosperous leading family of his small town. These are precisely the people whose world has been undermined by the entrance of minorities, the entrance of women into the larger social world, the infringements, as they understand it, of government in the free operations of their corporate operations. This is a very large company that he is a bearer of. Somebody was, by the way, parenthetically, somebody was asking today, how come he has all this money if he's only been in Congress for 14 years, never worked in the private sector? Well, the answer is he inherited most of it. Proprietors. He is the embodiment. He's almost like a character out of C. Wright Mills' Power Elite, published in the 50s. He's one of the possessed who fears being dispossessed. So in this sense, it's a very old story here. The right are those who have and who fear losing. That's a bit oversimple, but not altogether wrong.
Well, that may be the case of Paul Ryan and the Republican politicians, and indeed Romney himself. But the people they get to vote for them are blue-collar Reagan Democrats, the Joe the Plumbers, who don't literally have a damn thing to their name, but yet vote against their own interests. That's the genius of the Republicans. And, you know, Ryan is coming across as a blue-collar guy. And by the way, I did a piece yesterday, Todd, the source of his, most of the money, this $8 million that they've declared, most of it comes from the wife, who's father handles the oil and gas leases for Dan Boron, the congressman, who's the son of the former senator of Oklahoma. They're huge in the fracking business, in fracking for gas.
Yes, I saw that. Well, also, he inherits, Paul Ryan himself, from his mother, and she's the heir of the family construction business.
Well, of course, this is pales to the Romney fortune, right? About which we don't know very much.
We're all paled by that.
Yeah, because he won't release his taxes.
Our pallor shows. But what you say is, of course, true. And the Republican Party has been the party ever since the Southern Strategy, which brought the Republicans to power in 1968. The Republicans have been the beneficiaries of the white working class vote that would prefer to be in alignment with the wealthy corporate class than to be at home with racial minorities and the children of immigrants. So the white vote, the white male vote in particular, has been steady, roughly 55% for the Republicans since the 70s. That doesn't change. The only reason Barack Obama was able to win was that, of course, the complexion of the country quite literally has changed, and the white vote ain't what it used to be. Once again, the right built an alliance of both cultural and economic interests, which was more compendious, more retentive, more emotionally satisfying, and more, of course, able to engage the passions of voters who were most reliable, who were most likely to turn out. And turnout, of course, remains a major decisive factor in our elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Todd Gitlin. He's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of Students for Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a novel. His latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. By the way, apropos your book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeal of a Divine Election, Todd, preceding you today is Gideon Levy, who writes for Haaretz, the major newspaper in Israel, and was the spokesman for Shimon Peres. He is unbelievably pessimistic, as is most of his colleagues in journalism in Israel. They're convinced that Netanyahu is going to attack Iran in the fall before the American elections are over.
Yes, I read Gideon Levy. I respect him. He knows. I would say my most gloomy friends are Israelis these days. Although I just, I don't know what to expect. It could very well be hideous. But I do think it's interesting that I just saw today that 60% of Israelis are actually against attacking Iran, which is kind of startling.
Well, Gideon was saying that the more that they learn about the consequences of thousands of rockets raining down on them, the more for a long time the majority have wanted an attack on Iran, but he felt
we can always hope for sanity.
Right. That's pretty much. But anyway, let's get back to the subject of of your latest book, Letters to a Young Activist.
By the way, there is an Israeli angle here, too, that's sort of interest. There was this huge movement that erupted in Israel a year ago for domestic reallocation of funds and housing and so on, and it dissipated. It left no political trace, and that is there's actually an issue. It dovetails with the issue we were just talking about. There's a way in which those who believe in power, those who actually relish the use of power, organize to take and hold power. And those who are devoted to protest have a different cast of mind. They often feel more comfortable being outsiders than they're capable of imagining themselves as insiders. And that means that they're not serious about organizing for power. So it comes to pass that this immense movement that attracted the largest demonstrations in Israeli history, and of course was problematic and limited in a lot of ways, and certainly was not, I think, by any means adequate to the ongoing scandal and outrage of the occupation. But it dissipated without leaving a political trace. There's no party that represents it. There's no political strategy that furthers it. This is a perpetual problem for the left in our time. And we can see a similar, I think, flaw in the sort of Occupy-related movements in Europe. You have the Indignados in Spain, who are a wonderful and a thrilling sort of incandescent burst of political energy, but have no place in the political structure. We're living in a time when people on the left are enormously and reasonably ill-disposed toward political classes, don't believe in them, don't think they're competent, don't think that they're honorable, don't trust them. And yet, the alternative is blurry. The alternative lacks concreteness. And it means that the spirit, which is manifest, for example, in the Occupy movement, it surges up and then it dissipates. Now you see it, now you don't. Whereas the Tea Party, by contrast, is now the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Right. They took 65 seats. Karl Rove and Company and the Kochs poured the money in, and the political organization translated directly into political power.
And
whereas
Paul
the Occupy
Ryan
movement
is their guy.
And Paul Ryan's their guy, and they're running with the ball. Conversely, the Occupy movement feels that a plague on all their houses. They probably hate the Democrats more than the Republicans. At least that's what I see mostly on the far left in this country. Is the first instinct on people on the far left in this country is to attack somebody slightly to the right of them rather than the Republicans, who they give a free pass to.
Yes,
so
this is the well-known circular firing squad on the left.
So here we are trying to sort of inspire people and reverse the tide, and both of us are being pessimistic here. So,
well, I'm more mystic than pessimistic. I think there are a lot of unknowns in consideration now, and I would actually argue. I was thinking that actually the nomination of or the choice of Paul Ryan actually is auspicious, and my reasoning is something like this. I think it increases the chances that Obama is reelected. And I think it's likely now that Obama reelected would actually be a more progressive president, more vulnerable to the Occupy and Occupy-like insurgencies than the first term. Because, first of all, he would not be so tempted by the chimera of bipartisanship. Secondly, he would have to try to do more through executive orders and whatnot, and there would be no impediment to his taking seriously the sort of I would say implicit demands, not of the Occupy movement itself, which doesn't espouse demands, but of some of the forces around it, like the National Nurses Union, for example, which is a driving force within the coalition to implant a Robin Hood tax on Wall Street transactions, the groupings who are trying to lead a movement for for campaign for full public financing of elections, moves for increased tax progressivity, and so on. I think the outlook for all of those is paradoxically better, and therefore it would be rational and inspired, in fact, for those who came to life during the Occupy movement's heyday to understand that they'll play on a more beneficial ground if Obama is reelected president.
So what about, though, getting to that point, which is getting Obama reelected? In many ways, it seems that Romney is still trying to shore up his base, and that's why he chose Ryan, because he didn't really have the Tea Party on board, and now he has them on board. So he's not even at a point where he's trying to win over the swing voters in the center, who are supposedly what really matters in American elections. I think, conversely, you could make the case that maybe Obama doesn't really have his base so secure, because the young people in particular who voted for him in 2008, and, you know, obviously we've got to add into the equation the 5 million people that the Republicans have scrubbed off the rolls through voter suppression. How would you compare the Republicans to the Democrats in terms of their base? Because, you know, you're making the assumption that Obama's going to get reelected. Well, you appear to be.
Well, the polls, which are now able to ask with some reliability who's a likely voter as opposed to a registered voter, register a majority for Obama rather regularly. That's now the norm, and it hasn't moved. In fact, it's moved a bit, a point or two, toward Obama in the course of the summer. And in the swing states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, Virginia, that tendency is also alive. Basically, they're fighting now about 5% or so of undecided voters. And it's true that turnout is a big issue, and that's why Republican efforts at vote suppression have to be resisted so resolutely. But I think it will be difficult for Romney and Ryan to now re-present themselves as ordinary, moderate, old-fashioned Republicans. I mean, they're now to the right of Bush on most issues. And by the way, we were talking for a moment about the prospect of war. The Romney people are neocons. And so on all these grounds, I think I'd much rather be in Obama's shoes now than Romney's.
Well, what's so odd about Romney, of course, is that he probably isn't very ideological at all. He's a businessman, but he's chosen such an ideological running mate, and his campaign has moved so far into the ideological weeds as a result of pandering that, you know, it's almost as if the vice president in a Romney presidency might be running the show.
It doesn't really matter who he, quote unquote, really is. I mean, one doesn't live the presidency the way one lives a private life. One lives it as sort of the intersection of political forces. And the party that elects him, if he is reelected, is a straight down the line right wing party. He will have very, very little room to maneuver.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Todd Gitlin.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, the author of Undying, a Novel, and his latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.